Welcome to the Protectors Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Piccolo. Had a great guest on the Protectors tonight, Thomas Pecora. Thomas spent 24 years in the CIA, and he's got a ton of great stories. Now, one organization that is near to him, and that's what we're going to be talking about tonight, is the CIA Officers Memorial Foundation. That is our shout-out tonight from the Protectors. The CIA Officers Memorial Foundation supports the well-being and educational needs of children and spouses of all fallen CIA officers. So on behalf of the Protectors, I'm going to donate $50 to the CIA Officers Memorial Foundation. Now, if you match my donation, just send me an email, and I will gladly give you a Protectors hat and a special Protectors bottle breacher. So reach out, and please support them. Thank you. Got a special podcast tonight with Thomas Pecora. You know, a lot of times our agency personnel live in the shadows. Thomas is out of the shadows now, and he's just got done with his book, Life in the Crosshairs of the CIA's War on Terror, The Guardian. Is that correct?
Yeah, Thomas? Guardian, Life in the Crosshairs, yes.
It looks really good, and I'm actually going to order this tonight. Now, I notice you can order it everywhere, too, which is really cool.
Yes.
Awesome. So, Thomas, I went through your bio real quick. You know, I was looking back, and the first thing that popped to my mind was you're a CIA protective officer, and you, the Black Hawk down, bam, right there. Mm-hmm. How does that happen? I mean, how do you get into that world?
That's a great question. The book is the origin story behind the protective operations unit. That was later exposed to Benghazi. I was actually in the first official training class, and that was in 1991. And we were trained specifically to provide protection for our case officers going out to collect information in areas that were just too dangerous for them to operate on their own. So fast forward to basically the Black Hawk Down situation in Somalia. What we had happen is U.S. military went in and were, it's a humanitarian effort in Mogadishu, and our people were working to get information for them and for people back in Washington. So we were, we had to get out there and provide protection for our case officers, and they were moving around, and basically what I call Mad Max. It was about as lawless as you can get. And
now this brings us back to like, this is way pre 9/11, and where the case officers were more like the spies of the 007, you know, not really the 007, but kind of doing the circuit and working the embassies and stuff. Was this kind of like a new thing for them too, to have you guys like, hey, you know what, we got these armed guys? And
absolutely. It took a lot of adjustment because they're used to operating alone. They're used to operating in very basically environments that they can blend in. Here, they're not blending in. And the level of threat was just so high. So we had to work. That was one of the unusual things about the unit. We were tasked with doing clandestine protection, a low profile. So we wanted to move around the cities in ways that people wouldn't realize we were there. One of our mantras is, if you can't see us, you can't shoot us.
That's perfect. Now, let's backtrack even farther. How does someone, I mean, were you prior military? Or were you?
No, I came and I was coaching wrestling after getting my master's degree in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I answered an ad in the newspaper. And they said, oh, okay.
That's random.
Yes. It's pretty crazy story. And then I ended up getting in 1989, and I was put in as in the security generalist position, which is we have a uniform division, then we have a generalist division, basically, and which they call now the multi-discipline security officer, because we work in a variety of different areas like personnel security, protective security, computer security, physical security. So I ended up getting in there. And my first job was doing background investigations. And while I was doing that, I saw that they opened up a training course for this new unit called the Protective Operations Cadre.
Huh. And, you know, I keep trying to remember then to inform people who are millennials in that age group that back in the day we had to use newspapers and write letters and it wasn't, and things didn't happen overnight. So I can imagine, like, it's just random that out in Wisconsin there's an ad in the paper for, hey, you know what? And it was probably like, hey, call the recruitment center or something like that.
It was strange. And then a couple, I put an application in. A couple months later, I get a phone call, and at first I thought one of my buddies pulling a prank on me, and I didn't take him serious. And then I'm like, oh, okay. So I went down and met him in a hotel room and talked about my background, and then I ended up going taking a trip to Washington, D.C., where extensive vetting, polygraph, the whole nine yards. And then I ended up in September 5th, 1989. Which is also just a date that I'll never forget, because that was also the date we got hit moving around in Mogadishu.
Oh, wow. Now, how do you go, you know, that's one of the things, like, so you're a college guy, you're not a military, you're not an SF guy, you're not a SEAL. How do you get into the whole, like, do they send you to, like, I mean, I'm obviously you probably can't talk about some of the training, but can you talk about any of the training?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, in the book has got never before disclosed information about this this unit, how we operate. It's all brand new. And it's totally different than working in a military unit or a police element, because we were trained to do low profile clandestine operations in the foreign environments. So we were using tradecraft principles that the case officers were using, the spies. We used training principles that came from DEA, their undercover agents. We worked extensively with Secret Service to get the core theory for protection. And then we worked with other elements that do high-speed training and driving, surveillance work, weapons handling. So it's a different a very different animal than typical military type training.
Now, were you in? I mean, obviously you were in good shape. But like, what would you equate the security officer to, like, you know, the SF world or the military world or anything? Like
that? Well, the standard security officer really wasn't at the agency, doesn't do this kind of work. It's a very unique small set that go into this protection size, specifically this overseas protection unit. We have another unit, the director's protective staff. They've been around a long time, and that's more your traditional protection. That's mostly domestic, and that's a different element. But what we did was a lot more physical. I mean, you had to be ready to take care of the principal. You had to be able to respond to an attack. In places where maybe the closest hospital was 20 minutes away or 2 hours away.
That's a huge responsibility. So, I mean, you are basically like a small alpha team. I mean, it's a really cool situation to be in at someone at that age, and all of a sudden you have this responsibility. You're floating around the world doing important work. And, you know, back then the CIA really was in the shadows. I mean, I don't think we really saw what was going on until post 9/11, when you saw, you know, Jawbreaker and Johnny Michael Spann and everything about the real on the ground, boots on the ground CIA.
Yes, that you are correct. It was a lot of responsibility. And then back then we were working with, we were struggling to figure out how to do this in a really dangerous environment. We had to start getting armored cars into play. GPS were just three letters in the alphabet. They didn't exist back then.
I remember
using paper maps, or you just had to learn your way.
Yeah, you remember when the pluggers first came out? And people are like, what is this thing? And like, you know, you have to hit the one and the star and this, and it's like, oh my gosh. It was like, and there's no Thomas guides in Somalia. So I can only imagine.
If you lost your way off the main drags, you were lost. And that was one of the real dangers. And it actually was one of the problems that the Delta Force and the Rangers ended up having in Mogadishu during the battle. They couldn't keep track of where they were going when they got off to these side streets, and they got lost.
Just amazing world, you know. These are the things you don't really think about. You know, because, you know, let's say you're not military, you're not law enforcement, you're not anything, and you're just like, there are so much logistics to just go right, like moving 2 miles up the road.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The trying to operate in these environments took a lot of administrative support. And that's one thing that we had to gear up for, because as you look back over the last 20 years, we've been operating in these war zones, or what we call low intensity conflicts, Bosnia, Haiti, places in the Philippines. So we've had to learn to get in there quick.
Yeah. And that's a lot of people forget about. The Bosnias are still going on. The Philippines is, it's an absolute mess of just, yes, you know, that's a mess.
Southern Philippines have been, that's been one big show for a long time.
I know.
I spent a lot of time down there.
I'm sure. Because that's the thing. It's like, I'm looking at your career, went from 1989 to 2013. That is a long career to be, you know, kind of running and running.
Every major war zone since from 93 on, I hit it.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you wrote a book,
yes,
which is cool. Because I mean, that's one thing I did as soon as, as soon as I sat down, I said, you know what? I need to write a book. So I wrote about my time working the border on the cartel stuff and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. So these, you know, people, I keep bringing this up. I keep dating myself every time I have a podcast now. And I'm like, you know, it comes down to books. People really like books now. Yes. And back in the day, all it was books. You had to go to the library to get the information. But people, you know, they want a real book. And this book is 24 years of like the real CIA clandestine type stuff, the real 13 hours protective. I mean,
yep.
And that's the one thing I want to jump. Well, you know, and that's the thing is you kind of brought up in the beginning was like, hey, you know what? This was an ad in the paper. There really wasn't many of us out there. Now, I imagine that the agency eventually does go to like the contracted work.
That was in 2001. After,
yeah,
you know, after 9/11. Prior to that, it was all staff. And this, one of the reasons I wrote the book was the 13-hour story kind of just scratched the surface, but they alluded to that this unit had really started in after 9/11. And no, it actually started in basically the origin is 1990. The first official training class was 1991. So there was a long history of doing this work without anybody knowing about it.
You know what, though? That is one thing I've recognized, too, is that, you know, the Air Marshals used to be a very, very small unit. The Border Patrol was actually very small pre-90s. And then I was a customs special agent back in the day, and that was a smaller cadre. A lot of people don't realize that post 9/11, there was such a massive influx of every agency that you needed to.
Yes.
People forget that the origins were very, very Spartan.
Yes. And that includes the equipment and training. We had to, we had to learn to just make do with what we had. I mean, in Somalia, we didn't have sufficient armor. So we got some armor plating from a helicopter and we jury-rigged the vehicle. And in other places, we had to do a lot of the same stuff, and we had to adjust.
Yeah, and then that's like the you know, when Iraq started kicking off, people were removing the doors on the vehicles in order to, you know, run and gun. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, IEDs, and they started to have to do makeshift armor.
Oh, yeah.
And now we're going in like 20 years of war fighting. you know.
Yeah, with a lot of adjusting to the tactics of the enemy has forced us to change our tactics. I was posted to Iraq from 2004 to 2005, and that was when we closed Road Irish because of the dangers. It was the most dangerous road in the world. It's a road from the airport to the main city of Baghdad. And
yeah, I must have just missed you because I was up in Balad in 06.
Ah, okay. I hit everywhere up there.
I'm sure, man. I'm sure.
Yeah. But those were some crazy days because we had to started out with small arms fire. So then we armored up and we started using artillery shells planted in the road or along the sides of the road. So we started to we cleared all that out of the way. So it was nothing along the roads. And then we started doing patrols. And then they started bringing vehicles onto the road and basically hitting us with what we used to call car bombs, but now they call it
V-bids. I know, man.
Alphabet soup.
How do you deal with, you know, what I kind of wanted to jump into this later on in the conversation, but we'll jump into it now. I mean, because you have a life on the line. Your life is literally on the line. How do you deal with the stress? I mean, this is 20-something years of a stressful environment.
Yeah, moving around a lot. I was undercover for 23 out of 24 years, so I lied about what I did. And I had to, I did a lot of lying to family about where I was going. And there's a lot of stress. For me, it was a lot of like working out. And I used to coach wrestling. So I got into some of the martial arts. And I took a lot of trips, like personal vacation trips, to visit family members that I had working out in Asia. So I would go out there, and it was a way to just get rid of the stress and then come back to work. And I spent so much time on the road. Out of the 24 years I worked at the agency, the longest time I ever spent in one place was the 3 years that I was posted to Asia.
Oh, man. What years were you in Asia?
2001 to 2004.
Oh, very cool.
And during, you know, that long stretch, yeah.
Where was that at?
That was based Philippines and Thailand.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But great diving, great people, great really food. Cool. So, yeah.
Great.
But you brought up a good point. One of the things I wanted to do in my book is kind of peel back and do the origin story of the 13 hours group, the POC / GRS, Global Response Staff. But the other part was, and then also to kind of give the readers a chance to experience what it was like to do low profile protection, which is a little different animal than, you know, Secret Service or the big State Department mounted up Suburbans. And then the other part was the human toll, because we have people working 24/7, 365 in places all over the world where even the military doesn't go.
And, yeah. That's the thing is like, so, you know, you're moving a convoy out of the gate, you're moving a convoy of like, you know, tons of vehicle, but you know, you guys are just rolling really light. I mean, how do you
really light,
you know, later on we're talking like in the 2000s, what kind of like, you know, it's not like you're going to get a rapid QRF or anything, but what are you rolling with as far as gear?
Well,
you thousands of rounds of ammo.
Yeah. Well, see, that's the thing. The real theory is you don't get into a gunfight because they're always going to outnumber you.
Yeah.
Especially when you're in vehicles and you're right. And they're sedans. And, but see, that's where stealth and speed become your allies. If they look at you and they go, who is that? Oh, well, by the time they start thinking, you're already gone. And changing routes, changing your look, dressing local, anything to confuse them so that they don't think you're a viable target. And it's worked. This unit is incredibly successful considering all the war zones we were in and all, and the fact that some places there was zero QRF. And we've never lost a protectee doing our primary mission. Huh. We've only lost one officer in And that's a pretty, pretty good record.
Now, you know,
lost some do when they were doing secondary missions like static, mm-hmm. like in Benghazi and when they were at the annex or coast. When that individual, the suicide
yeah. bomber, mm-hmm.
but doing our main mission, we've been very, very successful.
Now you mentioned 13 hours and it's very interesting. One of my guests this week was Max Martini, who played one of the guys in 13 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the movie, you know, what do you think about the movie? Not to throw you on the spot.
Well,
I mean, it's Hollywood. It's a movie.
It's Hollywood. It's Hollywood.
Yeah.
But there's some of the, you know, the action scenes, they're trying to really show the chaos of the moment. And it's almost impossible to do that, even with movie, with Hollywood. I'll give you a little bit of a mindset thing. You're going into the dark, even though you may know the location, you have no idea who's also coming to the party. So the guys could have run into, you know, 50, 100 bad guys. They could have run into 50 or 100 good guys, but in the darkness, you don't know who's who. The chaos of those moments is hard to describe, even in a moving setting. So it's I give those guys tons of credit for mounting up and going in, but that's part of the job.
You don't know if it's going to be like a suicide mission or not.
Correct.
Especially when you know you're a handful of people out in the middle of a country with no backup.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And you know you're there. I mean, you know your circumstances. And we've been in there. This is where people don't understand that the State Department has done this many, many times. They put mm-hmm. people at risk many, many places. And most of the time, they roll the dice and they win. But in this case, they didn't. Yeah.
You know, I listen to these stories on my podcast and everywhere else. I'm just like, it's so frustrating, you know, I can only imagine being in the arena like yourself.
Yeah. The rising up through the ranks where I ended up being the head of security in Iraq for all of our operations. And then out in the Pakistan, Afghan theater, you're responsible for every single agency person on the ground, contractor and staff. And you've got to be able to account for them at any moment. And every operation, every activity has to be looked at through the prism of security. And it is, if you take your job seriously, it's a hell of a weight to carry. And, you know, all the security personnel, you know, being ready to go at a moment's notice. And everybody's watching you, even though they may not, you know, look at you directly, but they're watching how you're reacting to news of a car bombing attack at one of the bases or blue on green. So there's a situation where locals shoot up, you know, their trainers. It's a very tense situation.
Everything has a security aspect about it. Everything. I mean, there was an SF guy when I was over there that, just going to the latrine, he got electrocuted. It's little things. I mean, there's so much avenues that, you know.
Yeah, there's no OSHA out there.
No.
Are there? Those trailers are
yes.
Not always the best. There was quite a few places where there were the electrical conditions were bad. I mean, when we were moving into Saddam's palace that later became the embassy, they would send the Iraqi electricians up into the ceilings to run the wiring, and we lost, while I was there, we lost at least 3 of them.
Well, the other thing too is the Iraqis, you know, set in mortar positions, coordinates while they're working for you. How do you vet those people? Oh my gosh.
That's the hard part, was when you don't know the enemy. You don't know who they are because they're not wearing a uniform. And 1 minute they're working for you, next minute they're working against you.
I almost feel like we forgot Vietnam, you know, there's so many lessons learned in Vietnam about, you know, counterinsurgency and everything. And then, you know, 40, 50 years later, you know, you're dealing with the same type of booby traps and just craziness. But that's a podcast for all. That's a book right there. book. Now, besides Asia, let's change the topic a little bit. Sure. Let's get a little positive. This is the Protectors. Mm-hmm. We have inspiration. Because, man, you guys have some great stories, man. It's not just guys. It's guys and girls and everybody that's, like, putting their life on the line. I don't think I've had one guest yet who hasn't had, like, just the story.
Yeah, there's tons of stories. I'll tell you a lighthearted one.
That's where I'm getting Iraq, at. Give me a lighthearted one.
In Iraq, it wasn't all doom and gloom. The agency is and that's what we call ourselves. We don't call ourselves a company. That was an old term. The agency is almost always wet. That means we always have alcohol. And we usually have a bar. And at one point during that 2004-2005 time period, we were like the only bar, with one exception, in the area. And so it was a great way to get things done business-wise, because you could invite people to the bar, and everybody wanted to go to the CIA bar. And now, as the head of security, I was the senior bouncer. So I had to deal with all the security issues that go with that. And we had a party night on Thursday night, and they had a little disco ball in there, and there was dancing, and it was a great place to let off a little steam and forget for a moment where you are. And a lot of different people from different government agencies, and even some of the foreign military elements would get together there and actually get to know each other, and good business was done. So crazy days at the bar. Now, there was another bar nearby. I said, one exception, but that was like a Star Wars bar. It was run by, it was in the compound of a South African demining company.
Oh my God.
Okay. And the stories I heard, I never went in there, but the stories I heard were they swept up the eyeballs in the morning. It was rough. So I didn't want any of my people going into there.
That's one of the security aspects nobody ever talks about. Keep your people away from the Star Wars bars in third world countries.
And don't drive while you're drinking and carrying a gun.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I'd always make sure that people coming in the bars were disarmed before they came in.
Yes. Okay, besides Asia, what was your favorite post?
I enjoyed work in South America. For 3 years, I trained presidential level protection details for foreign governments. So I worked with the Bolivians, the Colombians, the Panamanians. Panamanians didn't like us much. I think they still remembered when we came in.
Oh, yeah.
Got rid of
their cash cow.
They didn't like that much. But I worked with a lot of great people. And these were people who were trying to keep their leaders safe. And so we would come in and they would be so happy to see us. And they'd be basically crying at the airport when we left, because we were giving them good training and equipment, and it was a real positive environment. So, and those places were relatively safe, except for Colombia. Colombia was getting blown up a little bit from the cartel.
What year was that?
That was 94.
Oh, yeah.
95, 96.
That was the age of the powder, you know?
Yeah.
Like the post Miami, and they started moving the corridors up to up through Mexico then. So
they were blowing up the city. I mean, it was a major battle between the Colombian government and the cartels.
Yeah,
so I never really got a chance to go out of Bogota.
What a crazy life, man. I love it. Your book is available everywhere now, right?
Yeah, on Barnes & Noble and Amazon. And we're doing a book signing at the famous Poison Pen on the 3rd of September. That's in Arizona, Scottsdale, Arizona. Cool. Yeah.
Now are you out here in DC by me?
No, I'm actually back in my hometown, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where I was born and raised. The grandson of a Titanic survivor.
Wow.
Yes.
That is very cool.
Yeah, I think some luck runs in the family.
Oh, my gosh.
I made it out of my career without any extra holes.
Exactly. It must be part of the blood, the DNA. All I could think of was cold because I went to college in Minnesota after I got out of the Army. Oh my gosh, it's so cold out there.
And it snowed up.
It's probably snowing. It probably snowed last week, didn't it?
I wouldn't be surprised.
Now, do you plan on doing any more book signings?
Yes, I'm working on doing one out in D.C. I'm hoping to do it at the Spy Museum.
Oh, that'd be awesome. Count me in.
Another one. Oh, great. I'll keep you in the loop. And that one we're looking forward to because that'll fit. I'm actually doing it in collaboration with two other gentlemen. Dave Austin, who wrote a book called Tehran Vengeance. And another CIA, that's a fiction book. And then another CIA officer who actually was on the director's protection staff and then left to do high net worth protection in the private sector. And his name is Mike Trott, and his book is called The Protectors.
So the Protectors. Kind of there we go. I like it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of a theme.
It is. Have you been on a Spycast yet, the podcast?
No, I have not.
Yeah, that's a pretty good one. That's a really good one. I like that. I'd love to see you on there.
Yeah, I did Soft Rep Radio twice.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah.
Really cool.
And they're a great bunch.
Yeah. Got to get you on the network now, all the podcasts and everything. Because that's one thing about the Protectors podcast. I don't make a dime, and I'm just here to help everybody that's a guest.
Oh, we appreciate that.
And hey, go ahead.
I was going to say, make a plug. You know, we talk about the career, and I feel very fortunate that I made it through my 24 without any mishaps, but that doesn't always work out for some. And some of our agency officers have perished in the line of duty. And at the CIA, we have a charity called the CIA Officer Memorial Foundation. And it's specifically to help families of slain officers. So I'm giving 10% of my profits for my book directly to that charity because I've seen the effect on our family members when we lose an officer.
Yeah, that's what we were talking about before we started the podcast was about, you know, the charities for these types of everybody I talk to has a different charity. And it's kind of, it really sucks that we have to have charities because there's so many people that have lost their life in a line of duty. And man, I really appreciate you pushing that out there. I'm going to add links to everything. Where else can we find you? Are you on any of the social media platforms?
Yes, I'm all over LinkedIn. And I have a Guardian Facebook page. And I'm also Guardian novel on Instagram, where I put some photos of like some of the events. I just attended Thriller Fest, which is a thriller writers convention in New York. And I'll be posting things from the book signing in Arizona. And then I put some other photos. I also have a YouTube video where I have actual pictures from the book, but they're in color, and then a few other extra pictures. So for people who may be interested in taking a look at some stuff before they buy the book, that's a great way to do it. Or go on to LinkedIn. I did sneak peeks of my book. I think I did 12 or 13 little excerpts from the book to give people an idea of what the book was like.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to check that out. I like the YouTube platform. And, you know, I really like LinkedIn now as far as because you're getting away from, you know, Twitter is just so drama filled. Instagram's awesome. And I really like LinkedIn when it comes down to just being able to get some stories out there quick and kind of, especially when it comes to, you know, professionals that want to read a decent book.
Absolutely. That's how I found you.
Exactly.
A lot of people were talking about on LinkedIn about your podcast, so I had to tune in. Wow, this is great.
It's the Protectors, man. Everybody talks about the Protectors. No, I'm just kidding. I love it. This is like my second career once I get done with the government is going to be just kind of doing this stuff. But Thomas, I really appreciate you coming on. Anything else you want to plug out before we go?
No, that's
it. Got your book. We got social media. We got a signing. We're going to get you on Spycast. That's great. The goal.
That would be great. Awesome. And I'll keep you in the loop on when we get the Spy Museum
book signing. Definitely.
Because I'll be back in D.C. for that.
Very cool. I'm over here by Tyson, so if you come over, do some agency stuff up this way.
He used to live near there.
I'm sure you did.
I was a mall rat at Tyson's when I was home.
Oh, that's great. Hey, thanks a lot for coming on.
Thank you, Jason. I appreciate that.